This is Intercom Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Welcome back to Endocrine Feedback Loop for our eighth episode. Today, we review for the first time an article from the Journal of the Endocrine Society and is one with potential implications on the care we provide to our patients with thyroid cancer. As another first, this is the first time that we get to look at a case series in one of these articles, and so we will spend some time considering the relevant methodology there as we typically do. We're also going to spend some time thinking about the overall landscape of thyroid cancer, particularly as it relates to low-risk disease. For this episode of Endocrine Feedback Loop, as usual, I'm joined by two endocrinologists to help us walk through this article. First, as a reminder, I host Endocrine Feedback Loop and work as a general endocrinologist at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Tennessee, where I am also one of the associate program directors for our fellowship program. Joining me today as our regular contributor is another program director, Amal Shibley Rahal, and she hails from the University of Iowa, where she directs their fellowship program, is one of the assistant deans at their medical school, and works as a general endocrinologist. And our guest expert today is Brian Haugen. Brian is at the University of Colorado, where he chairs their efforts in endocrine neoplasm research with a particular focus on thyroid disease, making him the perfect choice for our topic today. As always, everything we discuss will be our opinions only and not necessarily those of either our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. Today, we look at long-term results of treating with ethanol ablation 15 adult patients with CT1AN0 papillary thyroid microcarcinoma. It was published in the November edition of the JES with Ian Hay from the Mayo Clinic as the first author. Now, Amal will walk us through the author's introduction, highlighting some of the key points that they make, but also helping us understand some key points about thyroid cancer in general. Amal, why don't you take it away?
Thank you for the introduction, Chase. As Chase indicated, I'm going to start by highlighting the introduction provided by the authors for the background of this case series, as well as a discussion of micropapillary thyroid cancer in general. In the last 15 to 20 years, there's been an increase in thyroid ultrasound and ultrasound-guided thyroid FNAs. And this, as we all know, has led to an increase in the incidence of thyroid cancer. With that, we are detecting more papillary thyroid carcinoma, and those, in fact, account for 25 to 30% of all new cases of papillary thyroid cancer. And for the definition, papillary thyroid microcarcinoma is defined as a tumor that is less than 10 millimeters in diameter.
So, Mal, I think this would be a great time for us to discuss as a group the idea of overdiagnosis. So we're finding a lot more of these thyroid cancers. They've always been there, probably. And this is really just an increase of identifying these, probably not much, if any, a true increase in the incidence of these thyroid cancers. So I thought it would be helpful for us to consider that a little bit more, get Brian's input here about this overdiagnosis of thyroid cancer, and also How is this really happening, particularly if the most recent guidelines, including those from the ATA, actually recommend against even doing an FNA of nodules that are under a centimeter in diameter? Brian, can you shed any light for us on how this is happening?
Yes, Chase, thanks for having me and this interesting discussion. I think the idea of overdiagnosis, obviously, is something that is found that if it wasn't found and nothing was done about it, it wouldn't harm the patient. And we need to be careful about making these diagnoses. And I think one of the most seminal studies done was accidentally out of South Korea, finding really didn't affect outcome, but really was a burden on the health system and probably did unnecessary therapy on these patients. So that's why in the 2015 guidelines from the American Thyroid Association, we basically said for something under 10 millimeters, as long as you have a good ultrasound and it's not in some concerning area or concern for extrathyroidal extension, you don't even need to do a biopsy, even if it's a suspicious looking nodule. You can just monitor. So that is a new issue brought forth.
Thank you, Brian. And just as a follow-up to that, we will review what the 2015 ATA guidelines say when it comes to the treatment of papillary thyroid microcarcinoma if we do happen to biopsy a tumor that is less than 1 centimeter and we do find that it consists of cancer. One option is to do a lobectomy, given that the tumor is small, unifocal, intrathyroidal, and there's no prior history of head and neck radiation, no familial history of thyroid cancer, and no clinically detectable cervical nodal metastases. The other option is to just watch it, and this is what is referred to as active surveillance. I'm wondering if you could shed some light here on background data regarding these two approaches and their efficacy.
Yes, Amal. I think the idea of active surveillance, or some people call deferred therapy in some patients, is gaining strength. And a lot of this work came out of Japan with some very long-term studies in patients who had these papillary microcarcinomas and had active surveillance. And now we have 10 to 15 years of data. And what we really realize is if you select the right patient, and I think you listed those features very well. The other feature we are always concerned about is something that is posterior or near the trachea. We tend to be a bit more aggressive with those patients because there could be invasion posteriorly. But if you pick the right patients and you monitor, the rate of growth is only about 8% over 10 years, and the rate of new nodal metastases is about 3 to 4% over 10 years. We do find that patients who are younger tend to have growth, whereas patients who are older have less growth. So that should come into our decision making as well. Now there's more data out of many sites, one including Memorial Sloan Kettering, even up to 1.5 centimeter tumors now that people are looking. So I think as we move into the future, these criteria may even get slightly larger where we could potentially monitor these patients. But as long as you select them appropriately and have good ultrasound and are confident, I think that's a reasonable approach for active surveillance.
Very interesting. To follow up on your comment about the rate of growth differential by age, is it a function of how long you are going to live with that thyroid cancer? If you're younger, you're going to have it for a longer period of time? Or do we know anything about the nature of the cancer itself that makes it more likely to grow or metastasize?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful point. And I think the data is not solid, but the one thing is if you look over a 10-year period, so the same amount of time, there's growth in the younger people and not as much growth in the older people. So there is something inherent about the biology, whether it's the telomeres at the end of the chromosomes that are different and they can continue to progress until they senesce or stop, we don't know. But there is somewhat of a biological difference if you're younger, not simply that you're going to be watching it longer.
Going back to this case series, so I just listed what is formally recommended in the ATA guidelines. The authors in their introduction, however, talk about other approaches to these types of cancers that they describe as quote-unquote minimally invasive and non-surgical, such as ultrasound-guided percutaneous non-invasive ablation with laser, microwave ablation, radiofrequency ablation, and ethanol ablation, which is the topic of this particular paper. Again, what is our experience as physicians who take care of patients with thyroid cancer with these different types of non-surgical approaches?
I think if we look at our experience, meaning from the U.S., that experience is more limited, where we're really getting a lot of experience, as I said, from other places. Europe was one of the first places to do alcohol ablation. I believe primarily in Italy is where they started that. And a number of other places are doing these radio frequency, even high frequency ultrasound waves. There's just ways to destroy that tissue that we're looking at. Ethanol ablation started with lymph nodes, but now it's moving into benign nodules to shrink them or thyroid cancer. So most of these look at destroying the tissue at hand. And they all have fairly good efficacy at doing that. And I think the difference between them is just the operator and what the person is comfortable doing it. So if you're an institution that has very good radio frequency ablation, that could be a reasonable approach versus alcohol ablation. I think they're all relatively equally effective at destroying that tissue. And the side effects are slightly different, but most of them are pretty well tolerated. There's some pain, some fever with alcohol ablation. There can be a vocal cord dysfunction because of the recurrent laryngeal nerve, depending upon where the tissue is that you're trying to ablate. But overall, these are just various ways of destroying that targeted tissue, and they're reasonably similarly effective.
Thank you. So focusing on alcohol ablation for papillary thyroid cancer, microcancer, this manuscript describes a case series, which is the author's experience at the Mayo Clinic, with ethanol ablation as the primary therapy in 15 patients with papillary microcarcinoma.
Thank you, Amal and Brian. I think that really nicely sets the landscape. We have a long-standing approach of treating all of these patients with surgery, a more recent interest in this active surveillance. But now, as Brian just outlined for us, many other potential approaches that we need to be considering about that other places are far further along than we are in thinking about. And so I think it's really helpful to begin to take a look at some of this information, in particular here, ethanol ablation. Before we get into the details of the methods of this paper, we're going to take just a quick step back and think about a case series. These are things that we read all the time, but I think often don't stop to think about exactly how they work. We get fooled in thinking, well, they're relatively simple. There's not a lot of methodology there. But I do think there are several key points that we need to be thinking about. And as just a very basic description of how these work, a case series is taking a group of patients that have had a similar experience and simply describing, usually with good statistics, but as a basic description of what happened to them. And it could be something of a new disease that has manifested, or new manifestations of an old disease, and describing that experience. And often is the case, though, is a new treatment that's tried. And so these patients are all similar, so there's only a single group, but it describes what happened, how these patients presented, and then how they did throughout their treatment typically. When we think about, well, why would anybody do a study like this? I think it's helpful to review, because of the way that these take place, often the study is undertaken after the patients have already presented, after they've been treated. And so they're relatively easy and cheap studies to do, and they're great at being hypothesis generating. But I think the most important part of these is that it is a very good and quick way to introduce either new disease or new disease manifestations or new treatments into the medical literature, and then serve as a basis potentially for further investigation. The biggest downside to these studies, these reports that we always have to think about, is that there is not a comparison group. So everybody in this study has the key characteristics the same. So we'll look at it here, but these are all patients in this study treated with ethanol ablation. And so there isn't a comparison group, because you always have to wonder, well, what if we hadn't treated these folks at all? Or what if we had done what we normally do for treatment? Would it have been better or worse? And because there isn't a comparison group, we can't specifically and directly answer that question. Now, sometimes what authors will do to try to get around that to some degree are use of what are called historical controls. This can be helpful and is an accepted technique. It's important to know that they're not truly controls, because historical controls are patients that are taken from a different group. It may have been truly historical in the sense of, this is what we used to do in the past, and this was the data that we got from the outcomes, or it may be a different source altogether. The importance of that is that while it will give us a ballpark idea of different approaches and what those outcomes are, often these groups of individuals are very different from one another, and so they don't truly serve as a control group. The authors don't do a lot of that here. They do do a little bit of that, and we'll talk more about that in the discussion. It was appropriately done, but I think it's always helpful to be aware of exactly what we're comparing here, and that this isn't a true control group. So back to this study, as Amal mentioned, this is a case series of 15 patients, and these are all patients with papillary thyroid microcarcinoma. They were all treated with ethanol ablation at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, and the dates that were included here between 2010 and 2017. And at the time of diagnosis, all of these patients were offered the three different options that we outlined. So surgery was reviewed with these folks, had the option for active surveillance, but then ultimately the one that was chosen, ethanol ablation, was reviewed. And the authors do a really nice job in their methods of outlining the counseling that was done with these individuals. We'll talk later about the shared decision making and how important that is. But a really important point that the authors make is that that counseling did include the possibility of missing a level 6 node. So a central node, not something that would be seen. You would see lateral neck nodes well on ultrasound, and that's something that would affect the decision making. But level 6 nodes often and usually don't know about until the time of surgery. And then if you don't have surgery, have the possibility of missing those. So I thought that was a really important inclusion that the authors made, and wanted to get Brian's input on that, is how concerning is that feature? We'll look at the data here and to see if that played out to be a concern. But thinking about applying this on a broad scale, how worried might we be about missing these central nodes when we can't see them before intervention?
Yeah, Chase, I think one of the concerns here is missing clinically important disease. The idea of missing a potential lymph node that might have a microscopic deposit of thyroid cancer is probably not as large of a clinical concern. We know, again, from Japanese surgical data that if you take patients to surgery who have a papillary thyroid carcinoma as a primary tumor, the surgeon, even at the time of surgery, doesn't see abnormal lymph nodes and carefully does a neck dissection, upwards of 50% of those patients, 30 to 50%, are going to have microscopically involved lymph nodes. So I think the question is clinically involved lymph nodes. And really, again, in a lot of these patients, that's fairly low and can be picked up with ultrasound. It's just, as the authors pointed out, ultrasound in the central neck with the thyroid in place is not as sensitive. So I think it's a concern, and I think it's something the authors did a very good job of discussing with the patients ahead of time.
Good. Thank you. That's helpful to be thinking more about that. A few more words on the procedures that are used here. So in particular, at the Mayo, there were two designated interventional radiologists who did these procedures. And as the authors point out, and we'll think more about this as we come to the conclusions, they had significant experience, many decades combined of experience with ultrasound and doing related procedures. And they both reviewed these cases and approved these cases prior to moving ahead. So before the ethanol ablation injections were done, the size and vascularity of the tumors were assessed and documented. And then the injection itself was performed over two sessions on successive days using 95% ethanol. And then there was a specific follow-up protocol that was followed for all of these patients. So the first follow-up was 3 to 4 months after that initial ablation. The ultrasound was repeated, reviewed by these radiologists, and the size of the tumor was documented, and tumor volume was compared to that baseline. And also the Doppler flows were repeated, and consideration was given to the need for further ethanol injection, primarily based on whether or not the Doppler flow was eliminated from these tumors. There was then a second follow-up a year after the ablation, and then there was annual follow-up until there was stability of the volumes of these tumors, or if the ablated microcarcinoma was not even visible on imaging. After that, the interval between those return visits would be increased to 18 months and then eventually to 24 months. So that I think that gives us a sense of exactly what it was that the authors were doing here. And as we pointed out several times, I think they do a very good job of explaining and detailing exactly how they approach these individuals. So now that we understand that, we're going to look at the results that they present, and I'll turn that back over to Amal to walk us through that section.
Sure. So looking at the results of the case series, as we already mentioned, it included 15 patients. There were 10 women and 5 men. Two of those patients each had 2 foci of papillary thyroid microcarcinoma. So that adds up to 17 tumors in total. The median age was 45 years. The tumor sizes ranged from 4 to 10 millimeters with a mean of 7 millimeters. I will expand a little bit on the choice of the procedure that Chase hinted at. All the patients, as mentioned previously, were offered the surgical option and were also offered the observation option. And obviously all of them received ethanol ablation, and this is the breakdown of the patients. Four of the patients had significant comorbidities, and the surgeons felt that they would be high risk for a surgical procedure, so the surgeon recommended ethanol ablation. Five patients were specifically referred to the Mayo Clinic from other institutions for an ethanol ablation. So they came in with the mindset of wanting an ethanol ablation and were not interested in other treatments. And in six patients, there was an evaluation by a multidisciplinary team that included the surgeon, the endocrinologist, and the radiologist. And the shared decision-making methods were practiced here. And ultimately, it was recommended by the endocrinologist that the ethanol ablation should be the procedure of choice.
I wanted to chime in here. I think this is a good place to point out an important bias that can be present in these studies. So as a word, often biases get mentioned in observational studies. And almost always when you talk about a bias, it means, and this is true when we just use this word in general outside of the medical literature, but a bias is when you treat one group different from another. And here in the medical literature, it's often unintentional. But if you have a control group and compared with an intervention group or a group that had some sort of an exposure, what you want to try to understand is, did we treat one group different than another more than just an exposure? Was there another type of evaluation that was maybe unintentionally different? Did we ask questions that we maybe didn't ask of the other group? And that's typically what a bias is one group gets evaluated or treated more differently than is appreciated than the other group does. A referral bias is a little bit different, and that just refers to the group overall. And that is that the individuals who are in your study may not well represent the general population. This is always something that you have to think about from studies that come from large tertiary medical centers. Often patients are being referred there for particular reasons, and so it's not really representative of the general population. There are individuals that are getting referred to this center for X, Y, or Z reasons. And as Amal pointed out already, a third of these patients were specifically referred because the Mayo is offering these ethanol ablations, and that's why they got sent. So I think that makes it very obvious that many of these patients are not going to be representative of the general population that we see. It doesn't always make a difference. So you may be able to draw all the same conclusions from the data, but you at least have to be aware is that it's not automatically applicable to every patient that you're going to see if you're not in a center such as that. So I think that was nicely outlined by the authors of how these patients got here. And the reason that they did that and why that's so important is so that we can understand the risk for referral bias here. Amal?
Thank you, Chase. This is a very important point to keep in mind. Moving on to talk about the injection. As mentioned previously, the procedure itself happened in two separate injections on two consecutive days. And this was done in 16 out of the 17 tumors. Only one patient received just a single injection on day one. And three tumors, two of them being in a single patient, so three tumors in two patients received a repeat procedure at the first follow-up 3 months later because they still had evidence of Doppler flow on ultrasound. So three out of the 17 tumors did not completely ablate on the first go and needed another injection 3 months later. The rest of the tumors did not require that. In terms of what happened after those patients received their treatment, the follow-up was quite variable. It ranged from 10 months to 100 months with a median of 64 months. And the only complication that the authors observed after the ethanol ablation was transient neck discomfort, like Brian mentioned at the beginning of our discussion. There were no cases of thyroiditis as a result of the ethanol injections, and there were no cases of recurrent laryngeal nerve damage or dysfunction. The median shrinkage, if we put all 17 tumors together, the median shrinkage was 93%, and the Doppler flow was eliminated in all of them eventually. Now let's look a little bit more carefully about the shrinkage. Out of the 17 total tumors, 8 tumors became completely invisible on follow-up. And 9 tumors did not completely disappear, but nonetheless, they did shrink in size. If we focus a little bit on those 9 tumors that shrank but did not completely disappear, out of those, 7 shrank by more than 50%, and 2 shrank by less than 50%. So the shrinkage in those 9 tumors that did not completely disappear, the median shrinkage was 82%. The authors had reliable serial thyroglobulin measurements on 12 of their 15 patients. The mean thyroglobulin at baseline was 14 nanograms per milliliter, and the mean thyroglobulin at the last follow-up was 9.7 nanograms per milliliter. The thyroglobulin did not increase in any of the patients. And talking about long-term progression, particularly nodal metastases, on follow-up, there was no evidence of development of nodal metastases, and there was no evidence of a new primary tumor, and there were no cancer-related deaths. Here, I would like to point out that these are great results, but the follow-up is very variable, and in some of those patients, the follow-up was less than 10 months.
Thank you, Amal. So we're going to think more about that as we move into the discussion section here. And as we typically do, what we'll do is go through some of the points that the authors make about their evaluation of their own study. And along the way, and particularly at the end, we'll add some of our own thoughts about how this moves our field along and what else we need to be thinking about. So first of all, the way that the authors conclude, they summarize their findings here, is that ethanol ablation is highly effective, enthusiastically accepted by patients, and safe. And they point out, just like Amal summarized for us, is that all 17 of these tumors were smaller after the ethanol ablation, and that 8, in fact, couldn't even be seen on imaging. And they also point out that there was only mild neck discomfort and no detected long-term complications in these individuals. The authors then move on to make, I think, 2 arguments that are really important for the applicability of the data as they found it here. So the 2 arguments is that it's primarily concerning ethanol ablation comparing it to surgery. So one is that they make an argument is that ethanol ablation is safer than surgery. And the other point that they make that it is cheaper. So I'll go back a little bit into those 2 things because the authors do a nice job of summarizing the medical literature that's out there to support these 2 claims that they make. So the first one is that ethanol ablation is less risky. They point out, and this is the closest that the authors get to use of historical controls, taking a different group of people for comparison. So they look at individuals who have had surgery at the Mayo Clinic for papillary thyroid carcinoma, and they point out that there is, even in the skilled hands of the surgeons there, still a 2.2% risk of hypoparathyroidism or damage to the recurrent laryngeal nerve. And so they say, we didn't see any problems here, and so if you compare it to surgery, it's much safer, even when you're doing it with a relatively low risk of 2.2% with surgery, we didn't see anything at all. The one thing that I wanted to ask, and I wanted to ask Brian this in particular, because he alluded early on to some of the potential side effects here. So this is a case series of only 15 individuals. And if you're expecting side effects that might only show up in 1 or 2% of people, as is the case for surgery, can we really have any degree of confidence that we wouldn't see a similar frequency of side effects with ethanol ablation if we've only got 15 individuals in this report?
No, that's a very good point, Chase. If your denominator is not very big and you're looking for a 1% or 2% effect, we may not have gone through enough patients to see that. I think the other thing that's interesting here is at this institution, they were able to get 15 people over this period of time to do alcohol ablation, and we can see that they had 267 people who opted for surgery. And actually, a majority of them got a thyroidectomy, not a lobectomy. And remember, most of this work was done before the 2015 guidelines, so that's where a thyroidectomy was a standard of care. And if you look, the thyroidectomy is where we saw most of the ill effects, not with the lobectomy. So in a way, you'd want to compare this more directly to a lobectomy rather than the complete thyroidectomy, which is becoming lower on our list of approaches for these patients.
Good. So we'll keep thinking about that. We'll come back to that later, particularly as we think about potentially rolling out this intervention more broadly, including to practitioners who have perhaps not had nearly as much experience as the two who were involved in this study. So we'll come back to that. So that's the argument behind that ethanol ablation is safer. I would say our thoughts on that is certainly there's nothing that would make it look more worrisome, though we may not be able to be completely confident given the small numbers here that it is truly safer. The other big argument that the authors make in their conclusion is that it is cheaper. So they walk through a series of steps to make that argument. And one is that they go back to this idea of active surveillance. They point out that in the medical literature, there is conflicting data about comparison of active surveillance to surgery as to which is actually cheaper. And the reason for that is, as Brian pointed out early, is that there is a thought, and this is terminology that's come out of Mount Sinai, is that often active surveillance is really just deferring intervention, is that for a large number of individuals is that you're eventually going to do surgery. So in a meta-analysis that was referenced by the authors, 5.3% of tumors grow under active surveillance, and in 1.6% of the time, there are lymph node metastases that are identified on that imaging. So in those individuals, you will usually be undergoing surgery. It's only been deferred. And that's there's different data from different countries as to which of those approaches might be more expensive. The authors point out, however, that if you compare only the definitive therapies, that ethanol is going to be cheaper than surgery. So they say active surveillance is not definitive. It's for many individuals just deferring intervention. But if you look at just that definitive therapy, at least with the data that they have, ethanol ablation is going to be a cheaper approach. And I think that seems true. There's often might be more work as far as a rigorous analysis of the cost that goes into that to really prove that, but the data that they present from their own institution certainly does support that that's the case. What I thought would be helpful for us to again discuss as a group is a few other issues related to active surveillance, some key things about how intensive that needs to be, and also the intensity of the surveillance after ethanol ablation. Is trying to understand of those two approaches, because if someone's not interested in surgery, they're probably trying to weigh active surveillance versus ethanol. So that's often the real question that we're going to be weighing in this situation. So Brian, can I get you to chime in again here? How would you think about that? We don't have direct data comparing those two things. So how would you take what data is out there and try to weigh through that?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to obviously directly compare when we sort of do have these apples and oranges comparisons. One thing you always have to be careful about when looking at a study, when especially a study is making assumptions, I tend to see many studies making the assumptions that active surveillance, you will be doing an ultrasound a year for the rest of the patient's life. I think as we move forward, that's not a reasonable assumption. I think what we can do is over time stretch out that follow-up. And I have some patients that I'm currently doing active surveillance where we're doing this maybe once every 5 years. The other assumption you have to be careful about is what are we surveilling? Are we surveilling the tumor that was targeted only? Or are we surveilling contralateral lobe, other areas of the thyroid, lymph nodes? Even if you do a thyroidectomy, you do need to do some sort of surveillance to make sure there's no clinical lymph nodes that come back on these patients. So I think the idea of how often we surveil and what way we do it, we need to be thinking more deeply about and probably changing our practice patterns over time, especially if somebody has been out 5 or 10 years and has no recurrence.
Good. Thank you. That's helpful. We'll come back to what more data we might need in the future and what that would look like. Though I do think what data is presented by the authors, you could be reasonably confident that at least comparing the definitive therapies as they describe them, surgery versus ethanol, that ethanol is probably a more cost-effective approach.
Yeah, I agree.
Back to some of the comments that the authors make, particularly related to limitations. So, and this is something that Amal walked us through nicely in the introduction, is that not all patients are going to be good candidates for this. So they point out, this is consistent with guidelines, other individuals that you would want to really think about surgery as the go-to option would be those with extrathyroidal extension or those with tumors near the recurrent laryngeal nerve, in particular, probably not good candidates. And those individuals are not included in this study and probably would not be ones that we would think about, at least for the time being, for applying this therapy to. So the main conclusion that the authors come up with is that ethanol ablation is a good third alternative, is the way that they describe that, and a third alternative to surgery and active surveillance. So I think then that leads us really nicely, that I like that terminology, that third alternative, as a way of framing further discussion from us. And I think just a simple question would be, is up front, do we really need a third alternative? So just to play devil's advocate here, I would ask, could the default for these small cancers not be active surveillance? And then only for those individuals who progress, so not a small number, but it's a minority of them, only a little over 5% of them grow, less than 2% of them are going to have detectable lymph node metastases. Could we not reserve definitive therapy for those individuals and then perhaps go with ethanol if that's going to be the cheaper, but making active surveillance our default? And I thought it would be helpful for both Brian and Amal to chime in on that as to what their thoughts would be on employing such an approach.
I personally would be inclined towards the idea of active surveillance as the default in the appropriate patients who, you know, we've listed those guidelines or those criteria where it may not be necessarily the best way to go. Where I see a big pushback is with the patients sometimes, the idea of knowing that they have a cancer and watching it, and the discomfort and sort of the unsettled feelings that come with this, which is a cultural issue, I would say. And not to say that it is not possible to change it over time, but this is a major area of pushback that leads a lot of endocrinologists to refer those patients to surgery.
So Brian, why don't you give us your thoughts on that? So a couple of things. So one, just what would it be like if the active surveillance were the default for these microcarcinomas? And also, since you have a large number of patients that you're doing this for, how has that worked out? Has that been something that has come about primarily at your recommendation, or were the patients requesting that? How have you overcome some of these issues that Amal referenced that I think that we all see with our patients?
No, and I totally agree with Amal's points on what we need to do, and I tell my patients this all the time, is at the end of our visit, before the next visit at 6 months or 12 months, I want to make sure one thing they can do is sleep well at night. And I think there are a lot of patients who, no matter how much you assure them, they still have a lot of concerns and they would prefer something being done. I think in those patients, then when we talk about something being done, that's when we talk about alternatives of alcohol ablation versus potentially surgery in these patients. I think also that the Mayo group brought up very well is doing that serum thyroglobulin. We in the guidelines put that you don't necessarily need to do a preoperative serum thyroglobulin, but I tend to do it more and more in my patients, because if you have someone with a very high thyroglobulin, that may be more concerning with a microcarcinoma, and you may push them in a different direction. I think in the future, we'll also be using molecular markers to help push a patient one way or another, active surveillance, surgery, or now potentially alcohol ablation. But I agree, Chase, that I still think from the data that's out there in these very small tumors that maybe we shouldn't be calling carcinomas because they don't behave like a cancer that's gonna harm someone if you don't do something further. What we should be doing is looking more at active surveillance as our primary approach. And for various reasons we just discussed, patient satisfaction, patient concerns, our concerns medically, how good is the team, we can push them maybe into one of those other categories of surgery or alcohol ablation.
And Brian, I think that's a great point that you mentioned, and it ties in nicely to Amal's concern, is that changing that terminology could be helpful, because there is this pervasive thought that anything with cancer is going to be really, really bad and needs to be definitively taken care of. And so I think that could be a part of that cultural change that Amal was asking about, is potentially just changing that terminology. because of the simple fact that most of these, the vast majority of these, don't really act like a cancer, and that we shouldn't be giving it a name purely based on a pathologic description when clinically it doesn't act like that. So I think that's a great point. So then another thing I think that we need to be thinking about is if this were to be rolled out broadly, and we'll come to whether that should happen later, but if it's going to be rolled out broadly, how would we think about rolling that out at places that maybe don't have the expertise that the Mayo has? I think there's a couple of areas to where that would apply. One of them is with the ethanol ablation itself. So they point out that the interventional radiologists doing these procedures have many, many years of experience with ultrasound and related procedures. But I think there are other things as simple as shared decision making, and that a lot of institutions have expertise with that, but I think there are a lot of places that don't have expertise with that. And that certainly seems to be an important part of helping patients make decisions and guiding them in that process. So how are we going to think about that at places that don't have that expertise?
I think that has always been a struggle with a lot of things we do years ago with something like ultrasound. You know, to have good, and we still deal with that, have good ultrasound, people who can do ultrasound or interpret ultrasound. And I think as we think about rolling this out in places that don't necessarily have that volume and or expertise, if they're considering a procedure like this, is to refer them to a regional or a national center that has more expertise in this. And what some centers do over time is slowly gain that expertise. So to your question earlier, Chase, about how did we start doing this active surveillance, I think like a lot of places, it was patients who would come to us and say, can I do this? And we would, in shared decision-making, begin doing it. We got more comfortable with it. We did more patients, and then we feel more comfortable offering it to patients who don't outright ask. But I think it a lot of times is those patients who push and say, can I do this? Can I avoid surgery? Can I do this approach? And we start doing it with those folks who are not only willing, but asking for it. And then we gain some experience with that over time. But as it rolls out, I think at places that don't have that expertise, especially the technical expertise with alcohol ablation, patients should be referred to regional or national centers that have more expertise.
Another question for us to be thinking about, and Brian, I'll ask you to weigh in on this as well, is the ongoing question of, do we need more data? So this was as a case series. So when you think about the hierarchy of study designs that are out there, often when those are laid out, case reports and case series are at the bottom of that with other observational studies above that, and then towards the top, clinical trials, and then ultimately a meta-analysis of multiple clinical trials. So what sort of data do we need to really be conclusive about this? Do we need RCT data? And then if we do need it from a clinical trial, a randomized clinical trial, what sort of outcomes should we be looking for? Obviously, with something like this, looking for mortality is not going to be a helpful outcome. But if that's not, then what is, and what would be, in your mind, the gold standard? If we need something else, what does the gold standard RCT look like that involves an investigation of ethanol ablation?
So I think, backing up and looking at this to your broader question of, would we need many RTCs? Would we need a meta-analysis of many of these? I think the simple answer is probably not for this type of disease, because number one, when we think about cancer, is mortality. And you're right, Chase, that we're not really looking at decreasing mortality in this group of patients who has virtually a mortality of zero. Then the next question is are you able to keep them from needing surgery down the road? So I think that would maybe be one of the bigger endpoints we would look at. But I think with a study like this, the main endpoints we want to really look at is quality of life, patient satisfaction, issues like that, because we're not really looking at mortality, and the risk of having a clinical persistent or recurrent disease is very low. So I think what we need is probably more data, more studies, because this is only 15 patients. I think clinically we can, at some institutions, roll this out to some patients and maybe picking our patients with comorbidities, with where surgery is not such a good option, where active surveillance may not be such a good option. And gaining experience and getting experience from various centers, I think is probably the amount of data that eventually we're going to need here, and not a randomized control trial.
Good, that makes sense. So now as we wrap up here, what I want everyone to chime in on is a couple things, and starting with just thinking about the quality of this report overall. So we've made a few comments about that along the way, but well, Amal, we can start with you and then go to Brian after that. But what would be your impressions of this as a case series? How helpful, how good was this report overall, would you say?
I think as far as case reports go, I'm pleased with the quality of this report. It does contain acceptable granular data. I mean, granted, it's a limited number of patients with a limited number of tumors. And as I mentioned before, the follow-up is not very long in some of them. But to the extent that we keep those limitations in mind, the authors did look carefully at all available pieces of data and as much as possible to do those analyses on the progress of individual patients. I particularly like the detail in which they go into describing how they approached those 15 patients, which allowed us to glean sources of bias and shortcomings, because those are going to be important for us as we think about, can I apply this to my patients? Can I apply this in my center? So the level of transparency and the level of detailed description provided for the cases and the selection process and even the procedure itself, I think makes it a pretty good case report and very useful, if not necessarily to emulate, at least to truly analyze and think in depth about the implications of the procedure.
Yeah, I agree, Amal. I think they did a very good job here with the limited number of patients that they were able to get in this study. I really want to give Dr. Hay and his colleagues a lot of credit for, as he has done throughout his career, pushing the envelope, trying to have us think in a different way and approach things in a different way. And I think they did it very carefully. I think the shared decision-making was a really important part of this that they did a very good job of. And having that contemporaneous control group of surgery was also a strength of this study. So I think while there are many limitations of a case series, this is a strong case series report.
I agree. And I think in this situation, the primary limitations are one that are intrinsic to a case series. So I think given the constraints that go along with such a study, it was very well done, exactly what you would hope to see in such a report. So where I would like us to end then is thinking about, should this change our clinical practice? So Amal and Brian, as you think about folks who are listening, who are practicing endocrinologists, is this something that we are ready to start doing, that we're either ready to start asking our interventional radiologists to do, for us to learn how to do ourselves, or to be referring to centers that do it already? Or do we need to wait, because it's been pointed out, it's pretty small, it's only 15 folks, didn't have a long follow-up for everybody. Do we need to hold off for a little bit more information before we can start really changing our practice?
I can start as a non-thyroidologist. I think at least for larger medical centers and larger institutions, it's probably worth considering implementing or making ethanol ablations an option. I can definitely think of several patients in my practice and in my fellow's practice who could have benefited from this, who wanted an intervention, but a surgery was not a great option for them. As far as rolling it out widely and expecting every endocrine practice or every institution and every hospital do it, it might be a little bit too soon, because the problem with that would be dilution of the experience potentially. But I definitely would advocate for seriously considering this and making it an option at bigger referral places or regional institutions that capture patients from within their area or within their state. And one question actually that I wanted to bounce off of both of you is that in the study they had two interventional radiologists doing this. Is there any room for an endocrinologist who is skilled with ultrasound and ultrasound-guided FNA to do this?
Yeah, no, that's a very good thought, Amal. I think what I would say is with this now, we're not ready to roll it out big time with a study like this where anyone in practice who has an ultrasound machine, we all have access to 95% ethanol, that you could just start doing this. I think even at institutions, and we have our interventional radiologists do this at our institution, We need to still, I think at this point, consent our patients because this is still not what we would consider standard of practice. So doing a careful consent procedure, shared decision making. For people who are in practice who have a large volume of these patients, just like I think a number of people have done with lymph nodes, there are people out in practice who are doing alcohol ablation of lymph nodes. I think if they have a large volume and want to learn this, maybe go to a center that has specialists doing this, learn it, and begin to do it yourself, obviously, again, on those safer, more anterior nodules, ones that are easier to ablate if you have a high volume practice. But for a person who's not in a high volume thyroid tumor practice, I don't think we're ready.
And with that, I would like to thank Amal Shibley-Rahal and Brian Haugen for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I learned a great deal today and hope you all did as well. Please join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of Endocrine Society with special production oversight by Maggie Graham.